Chicagoan Luis Vasquez won the Joffrey Ballet's Winning Works competition for choreographers. The U of I alum originally taught himself to dance by watching videos.
This is when YouTube was first starting. I was about as self-taught as one can be in ballet.
Plus, as Illinois turns 200, we take a look back at one of the darker chapters in our history. We'll hear the story of a historic old house in southern Illinois where free black people were kidnapped and sold back into slavery. But first, the story of an undocumented immigrant in Illinois who decided it was time to come forward and write his own story.
You know, I think there's an experience that's particular to all immigrants everywhere in the world. Like, once you leave home, you can never go back. You know, you can never reach home or return home. You're always caught in the middle.
That's all coming up on this encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What does it mean to live among the shadows to be an undocumented immigrant in the U.S.? Jose Angel N. left Guadalajara as a teenager, and for almost the past 25 years, he's lived in the U.S., and he's written about his life in a memoir. It's called Illegal, Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. It's a haunting account of his life in the United States. The book has been adopted as a reading requirement for numerous Latino study courses across the country. I should note, Jose Angel's last name isn't listed on the book. We're not going to say it as well due to his status. He visited the Champaign-Urbana area back in January to speak at the University of Illinois. He joined me in studio. I started by asking him why he wrote this book.
That is a very complicated question, but I think this is a very good moment to reflect on that, actually, because when I wrote this book, I thought that many people were talking about the issue of undocumented immigration at the time, and the people who were actually affected by, you know, undocumented immigration were not being heard. You know, and I'm saying that because, you know, with the current debate on immigration, we're not talking about more than 10 million people. I mean, we're talking about DACA recipients and, you know, the debate about the border and chain migration and the lottery. But we're not talking about people like me, like 10 million or more people. Nobody has talked about it, not the Democrats or the Republicans. And back then, when I wrote this book, I wanted to, you know, to tell people that we're not invisible.
We're going to talk about the changes since you wrote the book and now in a few minutes. But I want to first just understand a little bit of your story. You came here when you were about 19. Why did you decide to come across the border?
I think the place where I come from a socially disadvantaged background, a place like that, you know, that's usually expected of you, that you will either go north or take a job where you're barely going to make ends meet every week. And, you know, I took my chances going north because that's actually a rite of passage for many of us. You know, that's how you become a man many times back where I come from. So that was sort of expected of me, and, you know, that's what I did.
And so you started working when you were a child. Your first job was when you were what? Like, you write about this in the book, when you were like 6 or 7?
Yeah, I think I was very young. I was probably, yeah, like 7. One of the things that one of my uncles did was distribute on a tray, you know, in our neighborhoods. They went to a bakery, and you will go to a bakery and they will give you a whole tray of all pan dulce, that's what we call it, you know, the pastries. And you will go around the houses in the neighborhood selling them or, you know, delivering them. And that's, you know, that was my first job. I went along with them, and, you know, I understood that was something that I needed to do in order to pitch in to my, you know, to the expenses in my family.
And so you write about the memory of how much that was a ritual for you, even as an adult, a way for you to sort of hold on to your memories as a child. Do you still have pan con dulce and coffee in the morning?
I try every time I get a chance. Unfortunately, it's not always there, but I wish I had it all the time. I love that. That's a good way to keep memory alive.
So you ended up paying about $2,000, was it, for your family paid, I imagine, to hire the coyote who smuggled you. Do you know how many jobs you had to work to pay that back? How long did it take you to pay that money back?
I think it probably took me about I don't know, 2 years or so, you know, because when I came to Chicago, I came with the idea that I was going to do whatever it took in order for me to pay, right? And in order for me to be able to save a little money and send it back home, or send money and then keep a little bit and save it and still pay for my own expenses. So it took probably like 2 years in order for me to pay that. It wasn't easy.
How did you end up in Chicago?
I do have relatives in Chicago who had been here for 20 years. You know, I mean, that's the Chicago has an interesting history, Illinois in general. Chicago has an interesting history with Mexican migration. We've been coming to this state for about 100 years.
I was going to say, a very long time.
Yeah, for about 100 years, we've been coming here, you know, right after the Mexican Revolution. And in Chicago, particularly in the area of Pilsen, for instance, you know, that's where the Mexican community was established, you know, at the turn of the 1960s or something like that. But there are so many different areas in Chicago as well, in the south suburbs and, you know, the west suburbs of Chicago, where there's a lot of, you know, there's a really big Mexican population.
So you were a translator, so of course you learned English when you came here. And you wrote that this put you at odds a little bit with many members of your family that were asking you oftentimes, why are you learning English? Why are you going to college? Why are you doing all of this? Why was that so important to you, first of all?
I think for me it was important when I first came to the U.S. to be able to communicate, to have a conversation with people, because, you know, I was witness to many instances when I being out with some of my relatives, they had to rely on their children to be able to communicate basic things, you know, for them. And I did not want that to happen to me. I said, this is not going to happen to me. I need to learn English. I need to learn how to rely on myself. You know, I can't just rely on someone else, especially on a child. So this is not going to happen to me. And I made it a point that I was going to learn English, and that got people a little upset with me, because at the time I was working at a factory. They had found a factory job for me on the first shift, which was highly coveted by people.
What time is the first shift?
It's very early, like 6 or
in
7
morning.
In the morning.
Okay.
Yes. So I worked there for about 2 weeks or 3, and then, you know, at the same time, I was thinking about how I was going to learn English. Everybody at the factory, most people at the factory also spoke Spanish. So you didn't
need to learn English.
Well, that would have been the problem. I didn't need to learn English, but I wanted to. So I started inquiring around, and I found out that I could attend, you know, a place where ESL classes were given. So what I decided, which upset some people around me, was to quit the factory job, which was, you know, what I came here to do. And what happened was that I left the job and I went on to wash dishes instead, because I will free my mornings.
But that paid less, I imagine.
That paid less.
And probably a lot less stability than a factory job.
Yes. I mean, it was always there. I mean, I was never out of a job. I worked at a restaurant for about 10 years. And, you know, I worked all the time and I put a lot of extra overtime. So
why do you think they were upset? I think this is do you think it was because you were doing something different?
I think it might have been that I was doing something different. And I come from a very conservative kind of background. And also the fact that, you know, they had the idea that I came here to work, that all of us had come here to work. And to them, learning English was a little bit of a luxury, I think. So remember, I mean, the place where I come from, most people have only had a chance to go to grammar school. And I was lucky enough to do a couple more years of schooling. And for them, that was enough. For many people, that was enough. Even when I was at the restaurant, some of the cooks will tell me, why do you keep going to school? The English that you need here is very basic. Like, yes, but it's not all I want. I want to be able to do more than this.
My guest is Jose Angel. He's the author of Illegal: Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. And as you're sharing this story, you went from learning English to becoming a philosophy major, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I want to ask you about, you were around 20 when you really started learning English. How hard was that? It took years, and I wanted to just ask you about that process.
Yes. So first it was learning English, right? That took about 2 years or so to complete. That was full time. I was going full time. So what happened was that after that, during my 2 years at ESL classes, one of the teachers told me that, so do you have high school? I'm not sure. What is that? This is what you do. You go to school, you have high school. I had to find out what the equivalent of that was back in Mexico. So they told me it is preparatoria. I'm like, no, I didn't get a chance to go to preparatoria. And what happened was that she told me, well, you can do that if you want. You can definitely do that. And all you have to do is take this book and come and take some classes here, some GED classes. And then, you'll be good. And when I asked some people around me, I'm like, what is this GED? They told me, well, you go, you do a test, you get a diploma, and then you're going to be able to have this wonderful job. So I did that. And I thought it was going to be easy, and it wasn't. It wasn't.
Because the test was in English.
It was in English, and I failed it. I took it, failed it, took it again, failed it again, until my third time.
And so you take the test, you took three times to try, but you did it, and then you decided to get your associate's degree. Why did you keep there? You write about this, that at a certain point I imagine this is part of your ambivalence of being in the U.S. and not being here legally and all of the complicated feelings that engenders. One thing that you realized was that books and that learning was in some ways an escape for you. Would that be right?
That's right. It's a little more complicated than that, too, because I didn't come here with the ambition of going to college. That was never on my radar. I mean, that's not what I came here to do. I came here to do whatever it took in order for me to make it, just to survive. If that meant getting down on my knees and scrubbing your toilets, that's what I was going to do. And I didn't start writing until very late in life when I started college, actually. But it wasn't immediately after learning English and getting my GED that I started college. Some years went by without me going to school. I didn't start college until I was like 27, by the time, many people have already graduated.
Because you were working.
I was
multiple
working.
Jobs.
And I didn't know that I could attend college either. And I wasn't thinking about it. It was not something that I wanted to do. I mean, it was never something that I thought about, because that's not what people do from my background.
I'm a philosophy major too.
Awesome. I love philosophy.
Why did you choose to major in philosophy?
Oh, well, what happened was that
it's not a great career path. There are a lot of people in public radio who are philosophers. It's the only place in journalism I found people who were philosophy majors also.
Yeah. Unless you go on and do a PhD, there's very little you can do with it. But, it gives you a lot of material to think about. When I first started, what happened was that I picked it. They give you all this list of classes that you can take. You can choose from them. And one of them said philosophy. I'm like, I wonder what that is. So I went to the first class. And, the teacher started talking about Plato and the cave and how people are chained in the cave. I'm like, that sounds so much like me. I mean, I can't believe that people are actually get paid to talk about this, and people write books about things that I can like have to go through, but other people only have to imagine and write about. So I was very intrigued by that idea, and So that's a, you know, I that's how I became, like, you know, passionate about philosophy in the beginning. And I decided, since I didn't have any guidance to begin with when I went to college, I'm like, okay, so philosophy might be as good as anything else, because, you know, since nobody in my family had ever gone to college, nobody expected anything from me.
Do you regret not choosing something more practical, like accounting or something like that?
I do write about that in the book, but that's only, you know, I'm being ironic about it. I mean, no, I will not have chosen anything else other than philosophy, you know, because it has given me these very critical tools that I didn't have before and which have become very helpful to me.
We're going to continue this conversation in just a minute with Jose Angel. He's the author of Illegal: Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Jose Angel N. He's the author of Illegal: Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. Jose Angel, so you were decided to study philosophy. You end up becoming a translator. And you wrote something that stuck with me. You said that by becoming a professional, you also became a much sadder man. Can you explain that?
Yes. What I was trying to say was that by becoming a professional, what happened to me was that here I am, right, going into the middle class of America, right, having a professional job, sitting in an office, having vacations paid and whatnot, was putting me really into a circle of people that I didn't belong, where I didn't belong. I had never been in this kind of environment before, whereas before that, I had lived in the south side of Chicago. Now I was living on the north side of Chicago. So I was removed physically, emotionally, and socially from the place where I had been living all of my life. On top of that, by being undocumented, I could not relate to most of the things that they did. You know, people will talk, well, in the summer, we're going to go to London and France, and we're going to do this, this, and that. And in winter, we may just go for a weekend to Mexico. You know, we're going to go to Cancun or Puerto Vallarta.
And you couldn't travel, obviously.
I couldn't travel. But, you know, I was sitting at the same table as them, you know, and they will ask me questions. And
they didn't know, to be clear. They didn't know about your status.
No, they did not know. So, you know, I became, you know, I felt this feeling of oppression by not being able to share with anybody what I was going through at the moment. Yes, I was achieving some sort of economic solvency. But at the same time, you know, I felt this that I could not communicate with people, you know, and it was very isolating for me to do that. That's when I started to think about writing a book like this, that, you know, what it meant to kind of go on to achieve things that you didn't even think of before. But at the same time, you know, disappearing because you don't really exist in a way that other people do.
When you wrote this book and you shared all of this, and you speak you speak on campuses all across the country sharing this story. What kind of responses do you get from students when you talk to them about this?
I was not expecting this kind of response from students who many, I imagine, are DACA recipients. But they come to me and they have embraced the book enthusiastically because it speaks to them. It speaks to their experience. But mainly what I hear when I speak on campuses like that is that this is the story of their parents. You know, that's the story that they have heard growing up. Many of them, they might have been brought to the States like that too, but they were too little to remember. But they do tell me that, you know, this is what their parents tell them about the crossing and living alive in the shadows.
And when you wrote this book, it was a different political climate than it is now. I wonder what you think about the way that we're talking about immigration policy now.
I honestly have become very skeptical and cynical about the whole political system. I think it is an entire farce what's going on right now because, you know, yes, people say we're talking about immigration, but we're not really talking about immigration. When you are leaving over 10 million people out of the conversation, they're talking about DACA and they're talking about building a wall. They're talking about ending the visa lottery system and they're talking about ending what they call chain migration, which is family reunification. I mean, they're not talking about more than 10 million people who are being left out of the conversation. And that's my main problem right now. Back in 2008, I mean, I was a little more optimistic, maybe more naive. I think now I'm more realistic because this is a conversation that I've been hearing. People, I mean, the person sitting in the Oval Office right now, you know, got elected on this very issue.
So I guess my question is, what do you want people to be talking about?
I would like people to understand that every single person in the U.S. and in, you know, in Mexico as well, we all benefit from the labor of an undocumented immigrant. All of us, in one way or another, you know, you wake up in the morning, you have breakfast. That piece of fruit that you have, those apples that you eat in the morning, they go through undocumented hands. You know, we pay our taxes, our very fair share of taxes, $10 billion per year. $10 billion with a B. I mean, that's not little. So what I'm trying to say is that people are an integral part of this society, people like myself. And the fact that we're not being talked about is just, I don't know, it seems a little hypocritical.
Jose Angel, I just wanted to ask you, it just seems like a strange question to ask someone, I think, who's spent more than half of your life here. But, you know, you're married, you're a father, you've spent more than half of your life here. Does this feel like home?
Yes and no, both at the same time. But what is home anyway? You know, I think there's an experience that particular to all immigrants everywhere in the world. Like, once you leave home, you can never go back. You know, you can never reach home or return home. You're always caught in the middle. But you have to count your blessings. You know, I mean, there are things that you, I mean, there's a reason. There's a reason why we migrate. We go to other places, right? And you have to come to terms with it.
Jose Angel N is the author of Illegal: Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. Jose Angel, thank you for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As Illinois celebrates our 200th anniversary this year, we've been delving into the state's history at various points. By the way, if you have a suggestion for something you'd like for us to look at, you can always email us. Our email's talk@21stshow.org. Today, back in 1838, a white man named John Crenshaw had a house built in southern Illinois, just 20 miles from the Kentucky border. He called it Hickory Hill, but locals began calling it the Crenshaw House, or the Old Slave House. Illinois was officially a free state back then, but the state still allowed for indentured servitude with contracts that lasted decades. And with the slave state of Kentucky just 10 miles away, Crenshaw was believed to have kidnapped free black men and women and sold them into slavery. It's just one piece of Illinois history the National Park Service has identified as a historic station on what's known as the Reverse Underground Railroad. But nobody's sure what will happen to the old slave house now, even though it is owned by the state of Illinois. Molly Parker is a reporter with the Southern Illinoisan. Mark Wagner is the director of SIU's Center for Archaeological Investigations. We spoke with them earlier. I started by asking Mark what the reverse Underground Railroad actually was.
The reverse Underground Railroad is really, it reflects a period of lawlessness in southeastern Illinois. And it also has to do with a lot of conflicting laws regarding slavery. People living in that area continue to operate. Even after slavery became illegal in 1825, if you look at the censuses, you'll see African-American people recorded as slaves as late as 1840. But what also happens is that because of the proximity to Kentucky, is that you have groups of slave hunters are entering into southern Illinois. And in some cases, they're in pursuit of runaways. In some cases, they're actually just looking for any free African-American that they can get away with and take back into slavery. And one thing that happens is after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in the 1850s, people in areas like Illinois are required by law to assist slave catchers who are in pursuit of runaways. So men can enter into southern Illinois and say they're in pursuit of runaways, and if you don't help them, it's a violation of the law.
Molly, what inspired you to first look into this? The Southern did a whole series on this house.
It's always been an interest to me. I toured that house in early 2000s with Senator Paul Simon. The late Senator Paul Simon took his honors class there. And even though I grew up in Southern Illinois, in the lower sort of Ohio River Valley counties, I didn't know about the house as a child growing up. So I was very fascinated that it existed just about an hour from where I grew up. And I remember him taking us there on a bus. I can't remember all the particulars. I don't think it was open to the public even by that point. But Senator Simon may have known the owners, and I know he had taken a couple of classes through there. And at the time, it was still set up like it had been when the Sist family, Mark can correct me, that owned it as somewhat of a tourist attraction, which we later learned may not have been exactly historically accurate, but it was still very chilling to see and to learn about. And so I was still just very much a young person back then, and coming back to the Southern, I wanted to know more. I also was curious, you know, the state bought it. We paid $500,000 for it. What are we going to do with it? How long can it just sit there? And then, of course, SIU had put out a press release with Mark's work talking about the fascinating research they had done there. So it was right for a revisit.
We'll get to the state part of this in a minute, Molly, and I want to ask you about that. But, Mark, let's go back to John Crenshaw. There's an interesting part of Illinois history of him being a salt baron. And can you explain how he took advantage of a loophole in Illinois law that still allowed for slavery?
That area down in Gallatin County had a major salt works or salt saline. And as early as 1803, the federal government protected that by establishing a 10,000 acre reservation around it where they forbid settlement. And then they would lease out the salines to various people who would try to make salt. And early on, it was a very important place for making salt. And Crenshaw was one of the men who would get a lease from the federal government and then later the state government and try to make salt down there. But what happens is through time, they cannot compete with salt works in slave states. And so when slavery becomes illegal in Illinois in 1818, an exemption is carved out for Gallatin County and that area around the salines where slavery is permitted to continue on until 1825. Because they make the argument, we can't make salt using free labor because it's a very awful, arduous task to make salt with all these boiling kettles. Even after it became illegal in 1825, the salt makers down there, and Crenshaw was one of them, continued to lease slaves from Kentucky, even though that was illegal. And they continued to do that sort of thing up until the 1830s. But what happened is through time, because of the fact that they couldn't compete with the slave states, that salt making became more and more unprofitable. But Crenshaw continued to try and make a living at it. He was involved in a number of other projects also. But through time, his use of slaves and attempts to make salt just were diminishing returns every time he tried to do it.
And Molly, John Crenshaw died in 1871. The house was bought by the Sisk family in 1913. And then you mentioned this when you were going through the house as a kid. I should note to our audience, it's not open to the public now. I think it's been closed since the mid-90s. But something during the 20th century, the owners turned it into kind of a tourist attraction. Can you explain that, Molly?
Yeah, and when I was there with Senator Simon, I was a sophomore or a junior at Southern Illinois University, and it was still set up like that, even though it was, I guess, no longer open for the touring public. I remember that because it was so startling. You would go up into the third floor. What I didn't really know at the time, but through Mark's education, I learned were basically props about the way it was set up in there. It looked like a prison up in a third floor attic, essentially, with these rooms with bars over it, ball and chain on the floor, a whipping post, which I don't think was even historically a whipping post. It was something from the yard that was used for something else technically in history. And so, but you got the image that they had kept these slaves that they had captured on the third floor. And that was the story that we were told. And it sounds like, the history that has actually unfolded there through the great research that's been done was certainly far more complex than that. And that probably, and I'll let Mark explain that, but it was interesting to me to learn that the way it was set up as a tourist attraction, which in some ways probably kept the house alive as far as like kept people coming through it, preserved its history, created some money for the family to keep for its upkeep, probably wasn't historically accurate, even though those things did happen there, even though it does appear that Crenshaw was involved in trading free Black people into the South. There are numerous stories about that, documentation about that, that perhaps the way it was set up and those of us who have been through the house when it was set up like that have it's a pretty shaking image, but it probably didn't transpire like that.
Yeah, Mark, what actually happened? As Molly's saying, it was sort of set up as a...
Well, one thing you have to remember is that paved roads first start coming into Southern Illinois in the 1820s. And just like today, there are boosters who want tourists to come down here, and they've got to have places for them to go. And the stories about that house first start developing in the 1920s, and a lot of the stories are consciously being told by boosters. People will not come down to see the John Hart Crenshaw house. People will come down to see a haunted house, and people will come down to see an old slave house. And so these stories get exaggerated about, he is associated with slavery. He is not a nice man. But these stories get laid on that house and to have tourists come visit it. And that is the goal. And Molly is correct. It's a double-edged sword in the sense of the family that owned it, if they couldn't have made money off of it, it would have been destroyed years ago. There's about only one other site I know of associated with slavery in Southern Illinois where the structure still stands. So, if the family had not been able to make, you have to take the good with the bad and hopefully correct the interpretation of that house.
We just have about a minute or two left. Molly, the state of Illinois bought the house in 2000. What's the plan with this? Is there a plan for this Crenshaw house?
Last time I checked in with the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, they said, that we're in an era of tight budgets. They didn't answer me directly about whether it would ever open, but they said, we're in the business of unfortunately shutting down and not opening things in the state of Illinois right now. And I think that's a shame. Even though it wasn't accurately portrayed under the Sisk family, I do think there are lessons to be learned there. And Mark has talked about that. This could be an interpretive site to talk about not only the reverse Underground Railroad, but the efforts on the Underground Railroad, and to talk about slavery and the history of slavery in Illinois that it did exist, to talk about the long arm of that historical racism and how that affects today, where people live, how they live, tying in things like what's happening in Carroll, current day, to the past. I think there's a lot of things that you could do there, but I don't. In the current state budget climate, I don't have much hope or nor been given indication that they plan to do anything anytime soon.
That's Molly Parker. She's a reporter with the Southern. We'll tweet out all of Molly's stories if you're interested in finding out more about this old slave house or the Crenshaw house. I want to thank Molly, as well as Mark Wagner. He's the director of SIU's Center for Archaeological Investigations, for giving us a little Illinois history lesson. Thank you, both of you.
Oh, happy
thank
to
you.
Do it.
You're listening to an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We've all seen dance competitions on TV, whether it's Dance Moms or So You Think You Can Dance, but the Joffrey Ballet in Chicago is offering the real deal through its Joffrey Academy of Dance. The 8th annual Winning Works Choreographic Competition gives choreographers from all around the world the chance to showcase their productions at the Joffrey. The Academy focused on calling out to quote-unquote ALANA artists, which stands for African, Latina, Asian, Arab, and Native American, for this particular competition. And the four choreographers who won this year had their productions performed at the Edlis Neeson Theater at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art earlier this year. One of the winning choreographers was actually a native of Chicago, Luis Vasquez. He graduated from the U of I, where he studied dance, and he went on to join Thodos Dance Chicago. I spoke with him and Joffrey's artistic director, Ashley Weider, back in March. I started by asking Luis to describe his ballet, which is called Sea of Comets.
I would describe Sea of Comets as sort of this ethereal, outer-worldly experience that still has very human ties. I love creating drama within an abstract environment. I sort of love trickling in the audience slowly into this new world. And then within that new world, they sort of make connections to the dancers and to the music. And then once they enter that world, then I sort of, you know, pull at the heartstrings and sort of keep the time churning and sort of into the sort of otherworldly thing. I try to create things that are abstract but still innately human, which I think dance as a medium of art really does well. And it's a great collaboration.
Luis, what can you tell us about the music you're working with?
Yeah, so my music is by the composer named Ezio Bozzo. This is my second piece I've choreographed to his music. I love his music because it's beautiful, it's dramatic, but it's sort of under the cusp of melodramatic, and that's right the wavelength that I want my choreography to live. To the dancers, I've described the music as a beautiful curtain. You know, sometimes we slash through the curtain, but sometimes we just let the curtain do its work, and so my choreography reflects that. You know, when there's beautiful crescendos in the music, sometimes I have the dancers be still so, you know, we can just appreciate the music too.
Ashley, this is the 8th year that the Joffrey has held the Winning Works competition. As I mentioned, Luis is one of four winning choreographers. How did you go about the search?
I think, in general, I mean, I'm really thrilled about that, you know, 8 years later, we're still having amazing success with it. And I think it's a really important platform for choreographers, but also for our studio trainee company. And so the process is that we have a call for people that are interested to come and create on the studio trainee program. They get a stipend, and we've been able to increase that stipend over the years. And I think that, we actually get a lot of applicants, and we go through a lot of material. You know, we're looking for people that really are trying to tell a story and that they have a craft to their work and they have an understanding of their work. And I would say, having seen Lewis's work, that there is amazing craft in it. And I think that you want to affect your audience with the craft of dance.
And Ashley, is there something particular you were looking for in choreographers or for the pieces that chose that were the winning choices?
Well, I think that we want to balance. So, you know, there is a big topic around in the world of dance now about giving a platform to more female choreographers. So we have Claudia Shearer, who has also created a work on the studio company. But I think it's having a program that's really balanced. And I think all four of the winners bring something very distinct of their own way of moving. And collectively, I think it makes for a very strong program.
How would you describe what Lewis brings that's distinctive?
I think that a little bit like what he was saying, that his work is abstract, and yet when you put, you know, somebody on a stage and you add other people, and there's a relationship and there's a connection, and I think how he has used the music that he has chosen to show a dynamic through those relationships with each other is giving us a story that maybe Lewis isn't going to tell us what it is, but we will find that story within ourselves.
Louis, I'm fascinated by the idea of how one becomes a choreographer. And I think there are probably lots of folks listening who were tuning into the Olympics and watching the ice dancing. There's lots of conversations about choreography. And I was thinking at the time, how does one become a choreographer for ice dancers or for Olympians? You studied dance in college. Have you always known that you wanted to work in dance, Louis?
Yes, I've always had a passion for sort of you know, bodies moving in time and space. I always loved anatomy was my favorite subject. And when I first saw dance, it's when it all sort of clicked for me. And I studied science on top of dance at the University of Illinois. And I think that really affects my choreography. One of my favorite classes was organic chemistry. I loved seeing the sort of molecules shift in space and sort of those organic pathways. And I try to parallel that in my choreography. There's sort of these mechanisms and lines and diagonals that sort of shape to highlight like a duet or a trio. And I think my eye naturally gravitates. So I imagine the dancers as sort of particles, or in this case, comets, sort of colliding and creating new organisms. So I think I've always had that visual eye and keen for movement. And then pursuing it as a career for me came to light in college. You know, the program I went to did an awesome job of really teaching us how to navigate a career in dance. And so it took flesh later in the years, but I think I've always sort of had that eye for sort of movement and, you know, art and how something can take shape and evolve within space.
And how did choreography come to you? How did you find that?
I had an amazing full circle moment with the Joffrey Ballet. I started dancing at the age of 17 through Joffrey's After School Matters program. This is when YouTube was first starting. I was about as self-taught as one can be in ballet. So I saw that the Joffrey had this community outreach program. I auditioned on a whim, and they took a chance on me as a dancer back then. And then now they're taking a chance on me again as a choreographer, and it's been a really full circle moment. And sort of in both auditions and in both cases, I felt very supported. Back then as a dancer, you know, they give you amazing instruction. They give you amazing motivation to really hone your craft. And then now coming back as a choreographer, I've had the amazing support of the Joffrey team. I've had access to incredible dancers. I've had an amazing ballet master. You know, choreography is one of those things where it's innately in you, but you do need a lot of logistics and help to flesh it out. And the Joffrey, in this case, has completely helped in that sense.
So, Louis, hold on. You taught yourself to dance watching YouTube?
Yeah, I sort of YouTube beginning ballet, and then I sort of was like, okay, that's first position, this is second position. You know, when I actually got into the studio, that's when I was like, oh, this is a lot harder than YouTube. I think what's so beautiful about ballet and dance especially is that it's really a craft that's handed down from teacher to student. You know, nothing really compares to that sort of one-on-one time you get with a ballet teacher. And I think that's why the art has survived and why it will continue to thrive, that sort of one-on-one attention. You can just really tell in students and teachers when you have that strong connection.
Ashley, for people who aren't familiar with the dance world, do you think there's a different kind of mindset between having a great onstage presence and a great behind-the-scenes one when you're thinking about choreographing all of this?
I think it's the balance of both of it. And I do think that, you know, for people that are not sure if they, you know, there's this sticking point, because people, if you talk about ballet, people see it as maybe sitting in one kind of idea. And I think that, you know, what we really do is we dance, and everything that we're given might have the language of ballet in it, but the broader look is that it's a dance performance. And I think that choreographically, the work you do behind the scenes is what's going to set you forward when you get to a performance. And I think that, you know, this is the thing about trying to define someone who has craft, because it's an innate thing that's built into the individual. You can certainly recognize it when you see someone's work and how they put it together and how it drives through the time frame that it's choreographed in. So I think that giving this opportunity to as many people as we can, and the success of having choreographers come through the Winning Works program, have gone on to now work with professional companies all over the country, I think says a lot about the benefits of it.
And I was going to ask you about that, Ashley. Why do you think it's important for the Joffrey to bring dancers or choreographers to provide this opportunity, as you're talking about these young choreographers like Louis, into this world?
I think because we really believe in diversity and equity and inclusion. And I think that that begins at the top. And I think that we want to be absolutely at the table with the rest of the world in changing our ideas about giving people opportunity. So I've always felt very strongly about it. And so I'm now in my 10th year as the artistic director. And as soon as we opened our academy, which was 9 years ago, we just thought that it was a fantastic opportunity for these dancers that are right on the brink of their professional career and having that experience of what is the collaboration of creating new work. It's an essential part of being a professional dancer. So putting the program together was really such a great love. And I think to see the results of it have been really just incredibly heartwarming.
Lewis, you're from Chicago. You went to the University of Illinois. You really have deep roots in Illinois, right?
Yeah.
What does it mean to have a show at the Joffrey?
It's a dream come true, to say the least. I've stuck around in Chicago because I really believe in Chicago's story. I believe it's such a vibrant city full of diversity, and I think I've stuck around here because the art that's created here is just reflective of that. You know, I always say art isn't created in a vacuum. It's always a sort of reflection about what's happening right now. And that's why, you know, art and dance has that sort of innate, you know, you're not really sure why you're feeling something, but you're feeling something. And I've stuck around in Chicago because I really am passionate about the mission, and presenting a work through one of the world's top ballet companies is just, I get chills every time I say it. It's been such an amazing honor of doing it.
And do you think that is a challenge, though? As I talk to lots of artists, whether they're musicians or like you in dance, do you feel like it is tougher to do something like this in Chicago versus New York, or for a lot of musicians, the West Coast is really important? I imagine for ballet, New York is also very important. Why do you think it's important to kind of make sure that you're still here in the Midwest?
For me, a lot is about just giving back to the community. You know, of course, I'm open to opportunities in other cities, but really, it warms my heart a little bit more to be able to present this work and give it back to the city that I came from. It's sort of this, I want to recycle and refuel the flame of the art in Chicago. And as soon as I'm a part of that, I want to immediately give it back. So that's why it's so important for me. I want to be a part of Chicago's history. I want to pave my own sort of pathway into Chicago's dance world.
Lewis Vasquez is a University of Illinois alum, a Chicago native, and one of the choreographers. I want to thank him, as well as the Joffrey's artistic director, Ashley Weider, for being with me. Thank you for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. What a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.